Ja, läs upp.
Hello, WGN listening audience.
Live from the biggest small town in America, it's the Saturday Night Special with Amy Goode.
Hello, 720 WGN, it's Amy Goode. On for the first time in like 4 months, and I've brought Hannah Stanley here with me tonight. We're hanging out. Really, there hasn't been a Saturday Night Special in like 4 or 5 months. The sports ball.
Right. There are so many balls in sports.
Yes. you know, because there's been like a sports listening audience up until when this show starts, you know what sports listeners really like? The word sports ball.
That's what I've heard.
They really enjoy that word because then they go and then text mean things and change the channel. Go listen to someone else.
Well, here's the thing. I can help with that transition because my wedding was at U.S. Cellular Field.
Oh, it was.
Big Sox fan.
Same.
My son's been on the field. And then Blackhawks. I'm a huge Hawks fan, hence my last name. It's the Hannah Stanley Cup.
Oh, is it now?
That's what I call it.
I'm just going to start telling people that. People are like, you know Hannah Stanley, right? Oh, no, you know she's like of Lord Stanley.
Lord Stanley. Well, okay, so this, I think you actually know this, but my daughter's name is Preston. This is not why we named her that, but Lord Stanley of Preston. The cup is from Preston, England.
I mean, if you would cut out all of the that's not why, I would have bought that just now.
That's totally like, that's why, okay. Because that is like six generations ago, our cup. It's my daughter's cup.
Yeah. So anyway, that brings us up to now.
Yes, it does.
On the perfect station for that.
I'm really, thank you for having me come in and sit with you. I haven't seen you physically in a very long time.
It's been a year, at least.
Really?
Yeah.
That's unfortunate.
Yeah, that's craziness.
It is.
And in honor of that, there was a parade.
There was a parade and there were fireworks because people were excited we were here and together.
That's right. The city shut down and it took us hours to get here.
It did.
Because we are, of course, referring to the holiday light parade that was happening on Michigan Avenue.
Michigan
tonight.
Avenue Light Festival.
Very beautiful.
Uh-huh.
It's lovely out there.
Marching bands.
Time of year. Is
Nikki
so
and
pretty.
Minnie.
Yeah, all the hits.
Yes. They kept on coming.
That's right.
It was ironic because people really, I mean, you can't get anywhere on Michigan Avenue.
No.
Foot traffic, car traffic, nothing. It's all shut down.
I was thinking of taking like a Lyft or an Uber from home tonight. I was like, I'll do that because it's so cold.
No.
No. Mm-hmm. I looked at it. Not only was it $700 to go just a very short distance, mm-hmm. but all the streets on the map were just traffic-y.
Yes, so. And it's interesting because we pulled into the parking lot and came upstairs, and there were like maybe six people in the lobby, and I looked outside, and there are barricades, and I know what barricades mean. Barricades mean the parade goes past our building.
Mm-hmm.
So we stood inside and watched the end of the parade. Did we see the lights? No, but we saw what we wanted, which was Mickey and Minnie.
That's right. That's all you really need.
Yep.
And the rest you can see from up here.
Yeah.
So.
Yes, ma'am.
We fought through those crowds. We are here.
Yes.
And as per the custom of the Saturday Night Special.
Yes. What is our topic?
The one topic, and we talk about it all evening long from many different points of view and many different aspects of it. And that topic tonight is food justice. It's a topic I've wanted to talk about a very long time on this show. But as I mentioned, I haven't been on the air in a while. But it's an interesting topic to me. I grew up in a restaurant family, and so I've always been really aware of that there are many touch points in the supply chain where things can go badly and things can go well from who is planting and working in fields and harvesting crops to who is getting food to restaurants and stores, who's able to access the food once it gets there. There's a lot of stuff there.
Now, I'm glad you said that specifically. There is a lot of stuff there because we can talk a million different tangents of that, be it profit margins and
right.
how they're very, very slim and in so many of those levels of the supply chain. What specifically are we focusing on?
Well, We are doing a general overview.
Okay.
We're not getting too specific on any of those. Like, I want to touch on all of it because I think when we think about food justice, we think about some of the stories that have gotten a lot of big attention, like Immokalee tomato workers. That's one, like, a lot of people know about that one. It was this big strike. We hear about agriculture workers. We hear about fair trade coffee. Like, we hear about those kind of things, I think, a lot enough. Mm-hmm. So I want to include that in the conversation, but I think there's so many other pieces of that, including, you know, especially the access part. Who can access the food needed to survive and all that stuff?
When Tom Hush, who we love and adore.
Esteemed producer Tom Hush.
Yes, of course. And I apologize for not putting that
the
in.
The full title.
Yes, that is on me. But when I was sent the topic of food justice, I knew what it meant. Mm-hmm. But I was like, well, that's an interesting phrase. Because I hadn't really heard food justice as something that's been a headline in papers and, you know, on PBS NewsHour and such.
It may not have made the papers, but in a lot of minority communities, you will find people are very much concerned about the fact that what is available is usually the corner store.
Yeah, the bodega.
The bodega.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to having a full-fledged supermarket, in a lot of minority communities, you're not going to find one at all.
Well, we don't have to do the third segment of the show now because because that just happened. Thank you, Jennings, for bringing. I'm just kidding. Well, there is a piece that I tweeted a couple of months ago. It's from The Guardian. It is really interesting. It's proposing the idea that instead of saying food deserts, because that implies that it's like a natural occurrence, that there's just nothing you can do about it. It's just fine. Some people don't have access.
If you just keep walking.
Yeah. Right. As opposed to, you know, calling something, instead of food desert, using language like food apartheid, then it's...
Where it looks like an injustice.
It's an injustice, and it's not a natural occurrence.
And it's fixable.
It is fixable. There's systemic stuff on top of it, but it's fixable. So we're going to talk about that here in a second. We got to take a break. Back in just a bit, Amy Guth and Hannah Stanley here on 720 WGN for the Saturday Night Special. WGN. It's Amy Guth and Hannah Stanley tonight on the Saturday Night Special. And as per the custom of this show, we pick one topic and we talk about it all evening long. And that topic tonight is all about food systems and food justice, because there's a lot of points at which our food system is just not doing the right thing. It's not helping us. It's not serving everyone equally. There's a lot to it. For those of you who follow me on Twitter, after the show, I'm going to tweet out a couple links for you. But in particular, there's a great piece from ChelseaGreen.com about really defining what it is, what is involved when we say food justice. Is it because I think it's that phrase is so attached to the labor movement, as I was saying before the break, it often gets intertwined with stuff like agricultural workers,
which can then go into migrant workers, which goes into immigration, and it's a slippery slope.
I mean, I'm here to talk about all those things.
We can talk about all of those things.
But this show is for the food part of that.
Yes.
So it's okay for things to be a slippery slope to me, but I think it sometimes if a hot button issue is adjacent, it can like take away the specificity,
mm-hmm.
right? Like immigration.
The crux of what we're...
Yeah, immigration is like such a topic that people have a lot of passion about in many different ways, and therefore suddenly people will like bring that in. You're like, but that's not what I'm talking about. There's something like people having safe working conditions. Right, but the... Okay. All right, sir, hang up.
We're not talking about labor unions right now. We're talking about food.
Right. Yes. And that's another thing. Like, people will get on that. So that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about just the moment food is planted all the way to the time it gets to us. What is that? What are
farm
all those
to
systems?
Fork. Is what we're trying to hit.
Yeah, and I think it's one of those interesting systemic topics because a lot of people step in different places.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of times people will step in. I know a bunch of people that are passionate on this topic because they had some food allergies and started looking into the foods that we're eating and realizing like, gosh, to just eat the things I need to survive or avoid eating the things I need that are like poison to me, it's really expensive.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens, you know, if you can't afford it, and what, you know, so I think that got people thinking about access and how unfair it is. Because at the end of the day, look, having nutritious food to eat is a right, not a privilege, as far as I'm concerned. Everybody deserves food.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And we treat it like, and we price it like, and we value it like, and talk about it like it is only for the wealthy elite. And that, like, if you have, especially, like, if you have a food intolerance or something, it's like, yeah, but you're poor, so have this, right? And I think that kind of, right, there's sort of a culture of, like, not listening to, not believing that, like, a food allergy is real or that an aversion to something is real. Like, this has come up a lot in correctional facilities.
Right.
Right? Of, you know, someone making a dietary choice, someone is celiac or kosher or halal or vegetarian for moral or ethical reasons, and making a choice and then not having access to do so. And I think that's, looking at it in a correctional facility is like a little microcosm of a lot of other stuff.
I'd also, institutionally, school food,
yeah,
is a whole other opportunity for us to talk about the fact that nutrition is something that we should value and focus on across the board.
Right. Instead of like only, you know, only wealthy people get access to healthy things. And that's how we've set it up.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So a lot of people have talked about this. I know I've talked about it on the station before. In times of travel, I know a lot of people with food issues that don't have those issues abroad. That,
right,
like allergies,
especially with gluten. That is one where they can go to Europe specifically, and they don't have problems with that. They can eat the pasta.
So there's this other layer too of safety in all this. Is where I'm.
What
going
are we
with that.
Doing here?
What are we doing?
That's messing with people's systems.
Yes, and you know a lot of that has to do with a lot agriculturally, where it became financially feasible to do the big monocropping. Before that, farmers had a lot of small different crops. There is a chef, and I will look up his name on the break and tweet this out a little bit later, but there's a chef who is in the southeast. I think he's maybe in northern Georgia, southeastern Tennessee, somewhere in there. I read about this guy who inherited a cookbook from his great-grandmother about all these recipes, and he started trying to go through it, and he decided he was going to cook through everything there. And as he was doing so, he realized so much of that produce wasn't available anymore.
Interesting.
He's like, there's not 15 different kinds of corn. There's one.
Right.
So he's using heirloom seeds and trying to kind of get all that back and make it accessible so that it's not all just this, you know, highly modified, super pesticide-y one crop that's supplying a lot of restaurants and institutions.
Right. And a lot of, let's say, the corn is making those farmers a lot of money because they can utilize it and sell it for different purposes other than feeding America and the world.
Well, there's that. See what I'm saying, you guys? There's a lot to this.
Yeah, so I don't blame the farmers for planting the crop that will pay bills.
That's right. No, absolutely not.
No, absolutely good for
not.
Them.
So my grandfather, of blessed memory, he was a farmer, and we talked about this topic at length, in which he described the point at the farm in which it became no longer financially feasible to grow all the things he wanted to, where he didn't really have a choice. He was like, I had to just kind of narrow it down to three and chop out 27 other things.
Uh-huh.
So he kept a little bit of land that he did his own garden on, but the rest, he was like, I really didn't have a choice but to turn all of this into corn.
Additionally, I mean, the best thing for the land is rotational farming, where you're going to have corn one year, soybeans the next, or a variety.
Yeah, all the things.
Doesn't work anymore.
No.
You can't do that. You have to have this field. And so therefore, to feed that land, to nourish it, you put in a lot of fertilizer and things that going to replace the nutrients, which we need for in the soil to help those crops grow. But it's not the way Earth wanted it to be done.
I mean, I'm not going to speak for Earth, but I think you're right, Hannah Stanley. I think
Earth
you're right.
Earth texted and said it was okay.
I worry. I hope Earth was using her manners when she texted, because sometimes people don't.
It was a verified Earth account, so that was okay.
She's got the blue check mark. We're delirious, is what we are.
A little bit.
Okay, so we're going to take a little break. When we come back, we have some guests lined up for you on this very wonderful topic of food justice, and we're going to just see what we learned tonight. Amy Guth and Hannah Stanley here on the Saturday Night Special on 720 WGN. Thank you. 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth and Hannah Stanley here on the Saturday Night Special. As per always on the show, we pick one topic and we talk about it all evening. And that topic tonight is about food justice and food systems and how we can maybe think about them in a little bit different way. Maybe we're going to learn something together tonight as we talk about the many places where we can improve access to food, quality of food, all these things. Access, not only to that, but access to who's around food, who's getting food, all the things.
And the quality of life of those who are bringing us food.
There's so much to it.
So much.
So much to it. So we're talking about all of these different things tonight. If you would like to give us a text, feel free. We do not have time for calls tonight, but texts we do for sure.
312-981-7200 is that text line. 312-981-7200. Tom Hush, esteemed producer Tom Hush, is taking those texts.
That's his full name. And again, he reads them, and he's a human being, so be nice. Don't be mean on them, because that is a thing. Like, he they're not read by robots. They're read by human beings.
No, he is a good human being. We would...
We love esteemed producer Tom Hush very much.
Yes.
So let us begin, because we have a lot to talk about tonight, many guests, many things to discuss. We are joined now by Jim Conwell, who's the Senior Director of Marketing and Communications at the Greater Chicago Food Depository. Hi, Jim. Thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
So this is a big, complicated topic. There's a lot going on with it. But let us start with your area of work and the Greater Chicago Food Depository. Tell us about that organization. I know we see your logo on a lot of things. We know you're a part of many things. But perhaps people don't know all the things that you do there and all the people that you serve.
The Greater Chicago Food Depository is Chicago's food bank. We serve the city of Chicago and Cook County suburbs. We're a nonprofit organization, and our mission is providing food for hungry people while striving to end hunger in our community. So we source and distribute food to people in need through a network of about 700 partner agencies and programs. That includes many of your neighborhood food pantries, soup kitchens, shelters, but we also work with after-school programs, senior centers, and even places like veterans hospitals to distribute food to people in need.
So you mentioned something I think is very key to kind of focus in on, and that was providing food while ending hunger. I think we think about that first step a lot. We think about, we donate canned goods, people get them who need food. We think about that.
Band-aids.
Yeah, the immediate thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we talk a little bit less, and this is just me, when I say we talk, I'm just kind of thinking anecdotally here. I think we tend to talk a little bit less about that long-term sustainability part. So talk to me about that and kind of the biggest issues facing the organization and our city.
Well, hunger is persistent in our community and across our nation. A decade after the Great Recession, there are still hundreds of thousands of families across the Chicago area who wake up without the food they need to be healthy and thrive. And the barriers to a family or a person having the food they need, it's often income. The root causes of hunger, unemployment, underemployment, poverty, or people who are unable to work, including older adults, children, people with disabilities. So some of the work we do to fulfill the entirety of our mission and address the root causes of hunger are job training. We have a culinary job training program at our facility on the southwest side where people who are unemployed and are seeking careers in food service can come get free job training to get a job in a restaurant or a commercial kitchen or with a catering company. But we also advocate for strong anti-hunger and anti-poverty policy at the local, state, and national level.
You mentioned the food insecurity affecting those who are really not capable of moving beyond that, be it elderly and children and those who are unable to work. How are those groups, those demos, able to be focused on really so that they can move past food insecurity?
Well, the way we address those priority populations is through increasing access to food, especially where people, we like to say where people live, learn, and in the case of children, play. We have meal programs for children after school during the summer, at community centers, after school programs, libraries, parks. We want to make sure kids have the food they need to grow up healthy and strong. For older adults, we have food distributions at some senior centers and community centers. But it's also about advocating for programs that will help them put food on their own tables, like the SNAP program, formerly known as food stamps. We advocate for that in Washington, D.C. That program is frequently threatened by budget cuts or additional rules that would make it harder for vulnerable populations to get the food they need. It is one of our nation's frontline defenses against hunger, and it works in tandem with food banks and the charitable sector to feed millions of Americans every day. So those are some ways that we work on ensuring greater food access to people who might not be able to work.
Amy mentioned it earlier that sort of the image that we come up with when we think of food depository, food banks, etc., is donating those canned goods. But we all know a balanced diet, which is so important, especially to our youth or our kids in school, involves produce and things that aren't as easily accessible here in Chicago, especially during this time of year. How is that something that you guys, and it's perishable. We can't donate right. lettuce to the food depository. What's the workaround there?
So actually, more than 37% of the food we distribute is fresh produce. It's one of our biggest priorities for our team, my colleagues who focus on food sourcing, whether we are asking for donations of fresh produce from growers or distributors or various points in the food supply chain, or purchasing fresh produce with the money we receive from our generous financial donors. So fresh produce is a big part of what we do. Of course, it's not something people can get through a traditional food drive, but that's also why we have been encouraging people to do virtual food drives if they want to help out this holiday season and beyond, because we can take the funds from those virtual food drives and use that to purchase the items we need most.
And by virtual food drive, you mean instead of bringing a canned good to get into the party or whatever, you mean it's a donation based, or is it online?
Yeah, we have a virtual food drive website. It's chicagosfoodbank.org/food drive, and that it's like an online shopping experience, but it also has a competitive element to it where coworkers or families, maybe folks at their Friendsgiving celebration, can put together a virtual food drive and go through an online shopping experience, pick the items that they want to donate, including things like fresh produce or milk, and put those in their basket, check out with their credit card, and then we use those funds to purchase the food we need.
Oh, game on.
I know you
We're
said
doing
competitive,
this.
And Amy, both of our eyebrows
We're
went
like,
up.
What?
We're like, we are so on this. I will beat
We're
you.
We're doing this. So you're going to see some competition from us there. That's what we're doing on that. So we're talking right now with Jim Conwell, who's the Senior Director of Marketing and Communications at the Greater Chicago Food Depository, about all of the programs there, all of the things. This time of year, around Thanksgiving, I think that's when a lot of people start thinking about your organization. They're thinking about, oh, here we're having this meal at home. Let's donate some things. But in fact, this is something that you need people's support all year long. What are some other, other ways to, other than people do this all year long, what are some other particularly tricky times when your organization really needs our support?
Well, we, as you mentioned, hunger doesn't have a season. It affects our neighbors every day of the year. But we understand the holidays are a time when so many of us reflect on the role that food plays in our lives, whether that's in a celebration or just giving thanks for the food we have. And so we want people to, of course, take their inspiration to help this cause and volunteer, give to a food drive, make a donation, advocate for policies that will help end hunger. And you can do that year-round. Sometimes a year where we might need more volunteers are later in the winter after the new year. After the holidays, we're always in need of volunteers, but also during the summer. We need volunteers to help repack food at our warehouse on the southwest side. We also, during the summer, need volunteer drivers to help deliver meals to our summer programs at parks and libraries across the city and the suburbs. So volunteers are needed year-round.
And what about looking at the year ahead? In 2019, what projects and initiatives will we be seeing from the Greater Chicago Food Depository?
So in 2019, we're going to continue to expand programs in a couple of key areas. One of that is our Healthy Student Market program, which started with elementary schools and CPS. It's essentially a pop-up food pantry distribution inside a school to serve the families of children who might attend that school. And it was really successful at that level. So we started expanding it with post-secondary schools, especially the City Colleges of Chicago. We have a great partnership with them. We're currently doing pop-up food pantries at all seven city colleges, but we're going to be expanding that to be permanent on-site food pantries that operate several days a week. So we've already established that at three of the city colleges. We're going to continue to grow that so that way people, students, who are attending city colleges and might need a little help putting food on their table and making ends meet, have one less thing to worry about as they invest in their future. We're also growing our partnerships with neighborhood health clinics. This is at the intersection of health and hunger. We know a lot of the people who we served and people who are struggling to put food on their table can suffer from health factors like diabetes, hypertension, heart disease, and we've been partnering with Cook County Health and Hospital System and Access Community Health and some other community health providers to screen people for food insecurity when they visit the clinic, and then the doctors will write them prescriptions for fresh produce that they can get from our trucks that go to the clinics. So those are two areas where we've been expanding. Another thing that we're focusing on right now on the policy front, and we'll continue to as the issue evolves, is the Farm Bill, which is currently being debated in Congress. And for us, it's important to protect the SNAP program, but other federal nutrition programs that feed millions of Americans in the Farm Bill. So we're doing a lot of work to stay in touch with our members of Congress and encourage them to protect SNAP.
Yeah, that's a very key one. That's that particular topic is one I've talked about a lot on this program because it's so very important and so nuanced. There are so many pieces to that. I think sometimes, you know, people representing the bill, pro or con, can kind of get on one line of talking and miss sort of the big picture of it sometimes.
Right.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that they can be written when you have the healthcare professionals, they can be written prescriptions for produce, which qualifies them to come to your mobile markets, your pop-up markets. What are other, how can people qualify aside from that?
Nearly all of our programs, of our 700 agencies and programs that we work with, you don't need to qualify. You just need to arrive on the day and time they're distributing and receive the food you need. And most of the distributions in our network, nearly all of them, they're the client choice model. So people, it's almost like a grocery shopping experience, can select the items they want or need and know what they'll use and leave behind the items that they know they can't use. So it reduces food waste and improves the dignity of the people we serve. But we also, with the prescription for fresh produce is really meant as a tool to get people to think about the role that food plays in their health a little bit differently. So that's the reason we do that.
That is such a great program. My face lit up when you said that. That's so exciting because, again, that's a topic I talk about so much here about you know, just broken healthcare systems and broken food systems, and that you're linking the two is so marvelous.
Viewing nutrition as a component of optimal health. really makes so
which
much
sense.
Which
is a no-brainer.
It prioritizes it to people,
it's
though, that wouldn't necessarily think about it.
It's one of those things we all know is real, but it's like in the system, the way we have them set up, they're just not, often those dots are not connected. So that is really wonderful. So we're going to have to let you go here in a minute because we're running out of time. But in addition to doing a food drive or a virtual food drive that you mentioned, what are some other ways that people can support the organization?
Well, people can volunteer with us any time of year. We need volunteers year-round, whether that is in our warehouse, which is around I-55 in Pulaski, or out at one of our community distributions. We also need volunteers to help with those, packing bags of fresh produce and helping people at the distributions. We also, we are always in need of individual financial donations, so we can do things like purchase food and keep our trucks on the road. Food drives, of course, we talked about, and then advocacy. If people are willing to raise their voices in defense of strong anti-hunger policy at the local, state, and national level, that's how we can really move the needle on the issue of hunger. People can learn about any of those ways to get involved at chicagosfoodbank.org. I would also say that anyone who's in need of help, whether that's some groceries or a hot meal, can visit chicagosfoodbank.org to find the nearest distribution to them in our network.
Is there an ability to get kids involved in volunteering and seeing what goes on and where those needs are within our community through you guys?
Yes, absolutely. We have some volunteer sessions, especially for kids. Some of our volunteer sessions are age 14 and up, depending on the task, but we do have kids' days where children 5 and up with their family can come and volunteer with us. We also have been doing a program lately that we call Nourish 101, and it's a an education program for school groups on the issue of hunger. So some of our team will do that going to schools or have school groups come to us where they can start to educate children on the reality of hunger in their community and ways they can get involved.
It all sounds so good. There's so many things going on over there. Thank you so much for talking with us tonight. Really appreciate all this information.
Thank you for having me on tonight. We really appreciate you dedicating an entire program to this issue, and thank you for everything you're doing.
Oh, gladly. Thank you for all that you're doing. We were just talking with Jim Conwell, Senior Director of Marketing and Communications at the Greater Chicago Food Depository. And again, for those of you who follow me on Twitter, I'm going to tweet out links to all the information that he shared tonight as we were talking, because there's a ton of good information there.
So much. Really, a lot of, you and I talk about this a lot. This is a topic we're aware of, and I can't count how many times we looked at each other like, that's
what?
So great, that's awesome.
We kept going, what? And I love that question that you asked him about kids getting involved.
It makes
super
it,
important.
My son, Grayson, has been able to volunteer at a food depository, and it made a huge difference. Mm-hmm. He understood, he valued things differently because he had more of an education.
That's
so I'm
really
glad that they do it at the Greater Chicago Food Depository as well. But if you're not in this area, look into the one in your area.
Yes, lots of ways to get involved. So again, we'll share all of that on the WGN Radio website once the podcast is up, and I will tweet it out after the show. We're going to take a little break. More of this topic of food justice and food systems when we come back. Amy Guth and Hannah Stanley here on the Saturday Night Special on 720 WGN. WGN. Hello, it's Amy Guth and Hannah Stanley here tonight on the Saturday Night Special, hanging out, talking about the one single topic of the evening, and that is about food justice and food systems. And there is a lot of stuff there, and we always say this on the show, right, where we say we kind of take something that seems like it's pretty straightforward, but as we start peeling layers back, it's always a complicated topic, and
this
there's a lot to it.
This is an onion of topics.
It is. I see what you did there, because it's a food.
It took me a second, but I was trying.
Yeah. So, there is, and there are many, I mean, I think that's the great news about this topic, is that there are many entry points into it. Some people get into it because they're looking at the food system, they're looking at food they eat. Some people, you know, see some kind of organization doing work and going, oh, I never thought about that. I see their message. I'm going to do something about this. I'm going to do something differently in my life or my house or whatever. And so there's a lot of ways in, and there's a lot of ways to think about this. And mm-hmm. the important part is that we are thinking about it and then we are talking about it. And it's one of those topics, like, we can't solve it all. Not one person is going to fix it all. Certainly not tonight here in 2 hours by any means. But it's important to talk through it and think about it and talk to people working in that area.
Right. And when this topic was first brought up to me, I said, I got a guy. And yeah. that's the thing I always say. I've got a guy. But immediately I thought of a program that I have been aware of, that someone who I have known for a long time, is spearheading. And so immediately, Bruno Abate came to mind. And, Bruno, good evening. Thank you for taking time out to talk to us about Recipe for Change.
Thank you. Good evening, everyone.
Hello. Good evening. Now, when I first learned about this, I went, this is brilliant. This is brilliant. You're taking your passion and helping, educate inmates who don't necessarily have a job training program per se, to have a path, a knowledge base, and a way to get employment once upon release. Tell me how this started, please.
Well, first of all, I don't know about the word inmates. I like to say humans. It's a very important to understand that the people that are in prison are human. So, and everyone makes mistakes in life, and they need an opportunity to be back in a society and with dignity. And so that's what I'm trying to do through food. As we know, food is very important. You know what when somebody come in the world, like a kid come in this world, what a kid wants, two things, like he wants food, and the other thing is love, right?
Sure.
So if one of these two will miss in this child, the life will be probably difficult and maybe miserable. So I do utilize the food to bring love, to bring dignity, self-esteem, and also it's an education. It's an education for people that are incarcerated. And, that's how I started. It was a call from God. So I never been in prison in my life. I never been, nobody in my family experienced the prison. And I don't even know where the jail was in Chicago, honestly. I've been living here for almost 20 years. I never know where the jail was in Chicago. So, God called me, and believe it or not, God called everyone. My, when I spoke with the Cardinal too in Chicago, I asked this question. I say, Cardinal, but God call everyone? He say, yes, but not too many people answer the phone. So, and I was lucky that night, at 3:30 in the morning, something happened and my life changed, and I've been dedicating my last 8 years to try to change a little better system in the prison system, actually. So through food.
So your organization, Recipe for Change, works with incarcerated people to do job training skills and other things to prepare them for upon release from incarceration to enter food service.
Yes, we do that. We have a wonderful program where our inmates learn how to make pizza from scratch, so from the dough, understand what flour means, and all the temperature, and how to make dough. But the important thing is to create, for many people, most of the people they are there, 80%, they probably never have a job. So we prepare them to understand what it means working, be without the people, what to do, how to talk with people. There is all different education that many people don't know. So that's what we do. We do every day. The first thing, you know, that's very important for me, I utilize food and to restore these people inside. Why everybody thinks, you know, the job is the solution, but if you're not prepared, if you never work in your life, when you have a job, you're going to fail after 2 weeks. And and that's what Recipe for Change do every day. We not only preparing them with a certificate, with sanitation certificate, they learn about nutrition, and they learn what food is. Well, you know, many people, majority of the people that are there, they don't know what basil is. They don't know what rosemary is. They don't know what zucchini is. So it's a kind of open mind and educate them. If they want to be in this industry, they have to know the basics. And but the important thing is to understand what it takes to go to work and work with other people and be on time and go to work every day if you want to keep your job. And also understand that you're going to go to work and you're going to make $12 to $15 to $16 an hour. So your paycheck will be like, you know, $450 a week, $500 a week. So it's a completely different life when people come from the street and they make $500 every day just to selling drugs. So it's like a training life every day, make them understand what the really world is when you go to work and if you want to change. Or you change or you go back in the same system and your life will be miserable forever. It's a choice that they have to make, and I cannot do too much about it. But I'm trying very hard to make that change for them. So
yeah, it certainly sounds that way. And addressing the recidivism end of things is a really important thing to think about. And so your program, you said it's been around for 8 years. What was that initial part like? Because I assume you can't just say, I have this idea, or as you said, you had a calling. I assume you can't just go to the jail and say, all right, this is my plan. This is what I want to do. So what?
That's what everything is strange to me. Every day when I go there, I say, oh my gosh, that's what I've done. I mean, it's so strange, everything. Why everything happens so fast? And when I say it's called from God, it really is. And it's hard to make people understand this, you know. And I understand if they don't understand. It just happened. Like I say, I wake up at 3:30 in the morning while my television was on, and my remote was 5 feet away. And I don't watch television. I'm once in a while. The time to realize what's going on, I saw there was a kind of documentary they were talking about how many children America incarcerated. And it was at the time 2,678 children under 14. They have a life in prison with no parole at that time. It was 2010. And that's it. I can't sleep anymore. So I sit on my desk while I have the habit to write everything happen every day. So I sit down and I start writing, and I realized when it was 8:30 in the morning that my body was cold, and I say, what I'm doing here? And I wrote about 10 pages. How can I change the prison system in America? Me, that I don't have the education, I don't even speak English, and I don't know nothing at that time about the prison system. So everything was very, very strange. And that's what happened. After that, the same day, another kind of, I call crazy things happened, that I have this like a visual thing. I saw in my, I saw this face, and I don't know his name, I don't know his phone number, and I remember that I met this gentleman to my previous restaurant that I used to have in the West Loop.
That was Folia
Market.
Yes.
It was Folia, yeah, yeah. 2000. I opened 2001, and I, yeah, and you remember the place was so small, and I'm always go to please people. I'm sorry you're waiting. I have a glass Prosecco. My name is Bruno.
Yes.
What do you
yes.
do? You know, kind of things like that. So, and one of this, my, I don't know how to say, please people, to be patient and thank you for coming in my restaurant. One of the gentlemen told me that he was working with the prison system. And that's what happened the same day that this, I saw this face and I remember those words. I work for the prison system. Now I don't know his name. I don't know his phone number. So this was 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And at 8 o'clock, 8 o'clock at night, I get out from my kitchen here at Toco on Milwaukee Avenue, and the guy was sitting at the bar.
Wait, the same guy that was at the West Loop? See, this was meant to be.
Yeah.
There's a lot of serendipity exactly. going on right there.
So when I saw him, I said, well, what are you doing here? Are you still working for the prison system? And he goes, I don't remember that. I met you 6 years ago, and we only talked for 3 minutes. And from there, I start the conversation. I ask, why are you here? Well, you know, at this point, everything was strange for me, the television and me writing all those things. And then and this guy show up, and I ask him this question. And he say, you know, actually, I made a mistake. I supposed to turn on Division, and I turn on Milwaukee, and I saw you. I saw you Toco here, and I saw you on TV a couple of weeks ago, and I said to myself, oh, one day I have to go see the guy. So he was there while somebody sent him there. And guess what? He was working with the juvenile prison in St. Charles.
And so he
was
led
the
to,
one.
I'm sorry, so he led to you entering this the system and working with...
Well, no, I told all this story. I said, listen, you know, you have to listen to me. Why? Sense of this last night at 3:30 in the morning, all these things happened to me, and I'm reading. I wrote all this stuff, and I don't know what's going on in my life right now. I just feel a lot of pressure, and I please help me, you know. And why the first page was say teaching people food, giving the possibility to learn something about food, and I also write what food will do to this people incarcerated. So I say, how can I do this? And he goes, listen, I don't have any power to say yes, come over. I will tomorrow make some phone call, and I'm going to call with the director and see if he can meet with you, but I don't promise nothing. So guess what? After 2 weeks, I was in St. Charles, and I started cooking for those kids.
So when you are now, are you still out in the youth centers, or are you just at Cook County Jail now?
No, I am in the Cook County Jail now, and I have about 8,000 square feet of space. 6,000 square feet is kitchen, and we have two big ovens. It's the first prison and jail in the world that we sell in 600-700 pizza every week to the incarcerated, to the people upstairs. So above me, I have 1,540 people. So
this is your
yeah.
you're making a huge difference in the lives of those people that you are teaching and educating, and not only learning how to have a job, a career, an opportunity once they are released, but also to take care of themselves and their families in a way they weren't able to either.
And so where can people go to find out more information about the organization and support?
One thing I like to say that, you know, like I said before, everybody's concentrated on job and things like that. But believe me, everybody in America has to know that we have 600,000 people with a mental illness in prison. And every day we got kids there. And that's when you have a mental problem, we lose a life every day. And I'm sorry, I get very emotional.
So
the program, we should have a program. I mean, people make mistakes. They pay for their mistakes. But we have to keep their dignity. We have to keep these people alive. You cannot incarcerate a human and just, these people get sick mentally. They cannot do anything, and they stay there just for a stupid mistake. Stay there 24 hours a day, close in a little cell. And that's why recent people change, helping these people to stay outside, to stay 40 hours away, and keep the brain going. And don't be a mental illness. This is the first thing that we do. And then they learn something. And then they learn that there is somebody there for them when nobody's there for them. I always bring the example. If any human now go outside and see there is an animal shelter where they treat animal bad, we're going to call the police. We're going to call somebody. But these people, they've been treated bad, and nobody can call for them and say, no, this human has been treated bad.
Right. There's so many, it quickly runs into, human rights conversations and all these other things. I wish that we could keep you on so much longer. I have so many more questions about the organization, but where can people go online to find out more? Unfortunately, we're out of time and we have to take a break now.
Yes. It's a Recipe for Change project.org. So, Recipe for Change project.org.
Sounds great.
We love any help. I appreciate that you give me this possibility.
Oh, Bruno, anytime.
Please keep me in mind why I really people need to know what's happening, and we need to help. We cannot incarcerate the 2.5 million people in this country. We cannot kill 8,000 people every year. We cannot kill child. We cannot kill family. We want a better neighbor. We want a better society. We need to do something. We have to start from there.
You are doing a lot, and it's you can tell that it's very, very meaningful work to you, and you can tell how much emotional investment you have in it. Thank you so much for being with us tonight. Really appreciate all of the thoughtful conversation. And for those of you who follow me on Twitter, I am going to be sure and share that that website. Again, it's recipeforchangeproject.org, so you can find out more about that organization and all the cool things they're doing, working with people who are incarcerated and working with them to help them learn about job skills, but so much more, as you could tell.
Absolutely. And it's going generationally, that will roll, that education.
See there are lots and lots. As we start unpacking this topic, there's so much there. And as we just saw, it moves into human rights issues and all of that stuff. So we are going to take a little break. We're running a little bit late because there was a lot to talk about there. Amy Guth and Hannah Stanley on the Saturday Night Special, back in just a bit on 720 WGN. WGN. Hello. It's Amy Guth and Hannah Stanley. We just had to play that jam for a minute. Very good music happening from esteemed producer Tom Hush this evening.
I enjoy the loungy music. It gets me into this, like, let's sit around and have a really deep conversation.
Let's sit around and talk about some things.
Yeah.
And this is the show where we do it. We pick one topic and we talk about it all evening. That topic tonight is all about food justice and food systems. And as it happens every time on the show, we start, pulling at some layers of the topic. And sure enough, it becomes a big topic really quickly. And we see there's a lot of levels to it and a lot of layers. And we have certainly been seeing that play out with all of our guests tonight, mm-hmm. for sure. So our next guest that joins us by phone is Jose Oliva, who is the co-director of the Food Chain Workers Alliance, here to talk with us about, we talk about this kind of at the top of the program, about all the different touch points in the food system and how there's an opportunity to make sure that we are making the right choices in all of those systems. And that, you know, quickly steps into other areas, as we've quickly learned tonight on the program. Jose, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Absolutely. It's an honor. Thank you for having me.
Certainly. I'm glad you could join us. Appreciate you taking time out of your Saturday evening. So to start, maybe tell us a bit about your organization and the work that you do there.
Sure. So the Food Chain Workers Alliance got started about 10 years ago, 2008, when several of us would run into each other at different conferences and events that were dealing with the topic that you're actually talking about tonight, Amy, food justice. And folks would talk about how food affects the environment and how food affects animals and how food affects communities. But no one was really addressing an issue that we thought was fairly important, which was how food affects the people who actually produce the food, transport the food, serve the food, you know, the workers, the 21.5 million people who are actually part of the food chain in this country. And so we decided that what we needed to do was actually bring all of those organizations together. And that way have a voice in that ongoing discourse that's taking place in this country today. So that was the genesis of the Food Chain Workers Alliance back in 2008. Since then, we've been working pretty hard to do some systemic changes for our food system. Most of our work has been centered around a policy that we call the Good Food Purchasing Policy, which has five value categories: healthy food, environmentally sustainable food, food that's good to animals, that's good to workers, and that is locally produced. And it's a policy that we pioneered back in 2012 in Los Angeles. We passed it there. Now it affects four cities. We've passed it in four cities, L.A., San Francisco, Oakland, and then we just got it done last year here in Chicago. So now the city of Chicago and the Chicago Public School System, which buys approximately $300 million worth of food every year, has to buy food that actually abides by those five basic principles that I just mentioned right now. So that's essentially a really quick snapshot of of our work and the kind of things that we like to do.
Well, I'm glad you listed that out because, I think sometimes we just kind of see it's got some kind of seal on it. It must be okay. It's certified in some way. But the five areas that you listed out are so essential and that's sort of what's been coming up a lot tonight is, and we haven't even gotten into the animal part of it,
right.
You know, and that is such a big issue too. And I think by just these five, touch points, really, these five areas of focus, you really do cover a lot of ground that quickly steps into other areas that we're looking at a lot of other bigger issues that are all connecting here through this food system.
Absolutely. The really interesting thing about doing work in the food system is that it is actually the nexus of many of the issues that we're facing as a society, right? So if you look at climate change, for instance, I'm not sure if any of your guests tonight have mentioned this, but one third of all the greenhouse gas emissions are actually produced by food waste. So that's just food that we don't eat, food that actually goes in the garbage instead of being composted. It's a preventable problem. It's something that doesn't have to be that way. but it is something that is directly related to the food system. And of course, you know, the work we do is primarily focused on food workers, right? And you're talking about 21.5 million people who work in our food system, making it the largest employment sector in the country. And also the lowest paid, right? Our median wage is $10 an hour. You have prevailing problems of race and gender inequity in the food system, where if you look at, for instance, the CEO makeup, you have 86% of all CEOs of the food system are white, and then you have almost an exact opposite inverse of 82% of all entry-level jobs in the food system are people of color. And so every single issue that you can think of that we're dealing with as a society today has probably its nexus, it's sort of the beginning of it in the food system.
When you went to the city of Chicago to present them this really mindset, but this idea of focusing on these elements to make smarter and choices that are better for people in general, how receptive were they? How long did that process take?
It took a little bit over 2 years. We started this process in 2015, January of 2015, through the Chicago Food Policy Action Council. And we, you know, talked it through with a number of different alder people, talked it through with the mayor's office, talked it through with the Chicago Public Schools, and many other sister agencies. And it really was a combination of both being able to have deep conversations with folks who genuinely care, who really do feel like they can have an impact both inside the administration and folks that we knew had enough power outside of the administration who had organized constituencies to apply gentle but yet firm pressure to elected officials to say our constituencies really care about these issues. These are not run-of-the-mill everyday issues. These are things that really impact on the future of our communities in ways that are pretty profound, pretty long-lasting. You know, and you had a very interesting mix of folks, right? Folks who care about animal welfare, folks who care about the environment, and of course labor organizations, both unions and worker centers, all talking with the same voice, right? And really making the same point that this was a policy that we needed here in Chicago and that was going to have an impact in all of our constituencies. So I think, you know, it took a while to get that conversation to have the impact that we wanted it to, but in the end, you know, October of 2016, we were able to pass the first in the Midwest, the first ordinance that made good food purchasing policy the law here in Chicago, and then quickly following after that, the Chicago Public Schools passed their resolution, and then the Park District and a few other sister agencies. Yeah. So it was a success in the end.
Yeah, one conversation at a time. But I love how you say talked it through. Like we chatted when we, you know, we all know
we had tea. It was nice,
and it was fine, and we agreed.
There were finger sandwiches.
When in
involved.
Fact, you know, yeah. Community organizing has many, many steps and tedious moments.
He
for
said
sure.
2 years, like it took a long time. I'm like, that's nothing
that's
around
right.
here.
Right.
That's fantastic.
I know, right. Well, we got to take a little break. I hope you'll stick with us because we have many more things to ask you, Jose. But including when we come back, I want to ask you about some resources that your organization has mm-hmm. available, including The Color of Food. I want to talk about that. So we will be back here in just a moment. Amy Guth and Hannah Stanley on the Saturday Night Special on 720 WGN. Hello, it's Amy Guth and Hannah Stanley on this Saturday Night Special. We've been talking about food justice tonight. It's a big topic. It is a big, big topic. And as is almost always the case on this show. We get to the end and we're like, oh, I need like four more hours to talk about all these topics that have just come, all these little pieces of things that have emerged throughout the program. But this is not a show where you solve anything. This is a show where you just talk about the issues and we think about them. We go forth into our evening thinking about them more.
And inform yourself really about some of the nuances of these issues.
That's right.
So that you can have conversations yourself with your friends and family.
That's right. We have been talking with Jose Oliva, who is the co-director of Food Chain Workers Alliance. Jose, we were just saying in the break, I wish we could keep you another 2 hours. The show only has minutes left, but you have so much wonderful information. So much here. We wish we could keep you around, but we'll have you back another time because this will not be the first or the last time that we talk about this topic for sure. So right before the break, we were talking about some resources that your organization has available for people. And one of those that I want to talk about is The Color of Food. Tell us about that, if you would.
Yeah, certainly. We do, you know, when we first started the organization, one of the things that we realized very quickly was that whenever we talk to anyone about our experiences as food workers, people often dismissed our stories as anecdotal. And of course they were, right? It was our experience, individual experiences of food workers. So we knew right away that we needed to do some research that was statistically significant and that really spoke to decision makers in the language that they were accustomed to hearing. So that meant that we needed to do some serious research and we needed to make sure that we also understood the history of the food system. And so one of the things that we realized right away, and of course, you know, you might have guessed this from my name, right? But I'm Latino. I'm an immigrant from Guatemala, and I came here in the 80s with my family, and the jobs that I had access to were restaurant jobs. Most of them were back-of-the-house jobs. Later on in my career, I was able to move my way up to the front of the house. But most of the folks that I knew that were immigrants like me also had jobs either in restaurants or meat packing plants, or some of the folks that came from rural areas ended up working in the farms. And what we knew for sure was that we were being exploited, right? That Latinos, immigrants were being exploited in the food system. We knew it from our own experiences, and we knew it from the experiences of the folks that we worked with. And we thought that this was a unique situation for us. And when we started to do the research that we did, we realized, wait a minute, this is actually a historic problem in the food system, because the food system in this country was actually founded on slavery, right? The folks who actually created the food system, the first food workers of this country, were African slaves that were brought here in the 1700s, 1800s, to work the fields of large plantations that were essentially the beginning of the agricultural, of the agribusiness, right, in this country. And so then that made us really take a huge step back and say, well, it isn't really just our story as immigrants, right, or as newly arrived immigrants to this country. It's the story of a lot of other people that came before us, and those are the shoulders that we're actually standing on as food workers. And so that's where this publication comes from. It's also a story, obviously, of our members, of folks who actually belong to the Food Chain Workers Alliance. Folks could easily find not just that publication, but many of the other research pieces that we've done on our website, which is simply foodchainworkers.org. And there's, you know, a fair amount of research that we've done over the years that goes over not just race in the food system, but also gender. There's the huge gender gap in terms of pay, and the issue, for instance, of tipping in the restaurant industry is something that not a lot of people think of it this way, but it's actually really about gender inequity. When you think about the women who work as waitresses, and you think about the sexual harassment that they're exposed to by both patrons and coworkers, and the fact that they have to continue to serve to that table because the tips literally are paying the bills. They don't really get a wage from the restaurant. It sort of shines a new light on the kind of harassment and sexual exploitation in general that those women have to put up with. So there's a ton of resources that folks can access by visiting our website or getting in touch with me. We obviously always are eager to connect with new folks and educate people about food workers in the United States.
Wonderful. And can you give us that website one more time?
Absolutely. It's foodchainworkers.org.
Excellent. Foodchainworkers.org. That will be up at the WGNRadio.com website. And for those of you who follow me on Twitter, I'm going to be sure and tweet it out after the program so you can have access to it. Jose, thank you so much for being with us. I wish we had two more hours to talk with you, but we will have you back on for sure.
I would love to. Thank you both.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time already, Hannah Stanley.
It is unfortunate because, like you said, especially with Jose and all of our great guests, we could have gone on and on and on. And really, you and I could have just gone on and on.
We could have just sat here for hours ourselves.
It really is so nice to have been able to, been invited to sit in with you and get to explore this topic with you.
Always a pleasure, Hannah Stanley.
Thank you.